I made my New Year's resolution.
We're continuing to ring in the new year with resolutions for other people. Now to the world of entertainment. We're joined by actor and comedian Aisha Tyler. You may know her from roles on The Ghost Whisperer, Friends, or CSI. She's currently the voice of super spy Lana Kane on the animated TV series Archer. And welcome.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with music. It was a very big year for Beyonce and Lady Gaga. They ruled the charts. Taylor Swift really came into her own. She sold 1 million copies of her album Speak Now in its debut week. What are your resolutions for her looking ahead to 2011?
Well, I have two resolutions. It's always nice to have a resolution that focuses on improving your life, but I would love for her to get a little bit more edge. I mean, I like it that she's got this very ladylike image, but it would be nice to see a little bit more of her edge come out. I love graciousness. She was so gracious during the Kanye West controversy, but wouldn't it be nice for her to just, I don't know, get in a Twitter war with someone, you know, or just deck some kind of obnoxious fan in a bar. Just a little bit of a bite. It's time to get in a bar fight, Taylor. Come on. We know you got it in you. She's tough as nails. And it would just be nice for her to come into her own as a fully formed woman. You can't be peaches and cream all the time, Taylor.
Two A-list movie stars didn't have such a good 2010. Angelina Jolie and Jennifer Aniston had a few box office flops. What should they do to get back on track?
Well, obviously, getting into some kind of a pitched public battle about relationships is not going to change anything.
It's been tried.
It's already been tried. It's already failed. But, you know, for both, I mean, obviously, Angelina is rich as God and has 1 million babies. She doesn't really need to do anything. I think just maybe resolve to be a little bit more awesome. Save more babies, give more money to charity, walk on water. Maybe her resolution should be to walk on water this year. I think if she worked hard enough at it, because she is thin enough, the right amount of surface tension, the right meniscus around the edges of a surface of water, and Angelina could walk on it. And as for Jennifer, she's a lovely person inside and out, and she should go do some really awesome art house films, something like A Blue Valentine. Go for it.
All right, moving on to TV. American Idol returns later this month. It will have two new judges, Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez. Simon Cowell is gone.
Mm.
Any resolutions for the newbies on the block?
Is that show still on? Wow. I would like them to be nice. I would like their resolution to be kind. And I'd like a few more hugs. I'd like the kids to get hugged a little more.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
Let's be nice to these poor kids. They're going to have to go back to working at the Tasty Freeze anyway. So let's hug them, you know, because that American Idol reign is shorter every year. Remember in the good old days where those people were famous for a good 18 months? Now it's like 3 weeks. And then you pull through the drive-thru and like, hey, weren't you third runner-up on American Idol? And they're singing, would you like fries with that shake? So let's just be kinder. I'd like a kinder, gentler American Idol this season.
Finally, we have the highest paid actor on TV, Charlie Sheen of 2.5 Men. He makes over $1 million an episode. But as readers of the gossip pages know, he's had a troubled personal life. Resolutions for Charlie Sheen.
What are my resolutions for Charlie Sheen? I'm going to make a resolution for myself, which is that I'm going to go out and trash a hotel room immediately. Apparently, that really pays off. I'm always the one who saves the soap bar and tries to recycle and hangs up her towels. And from now on, it's going to be nothing but broken lamps and shards of crystal in every hotel room that I stay in, because apparently that gets you $1 million an episode.
Aisha Tyler is the voice of Lana Kane on the animated series Archer. The second season of Archer begins January 27th on FX. Aisha, this was fun. Thank you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Everybody, save yourselves from disappointment. Don't make resolutions. You'll only disappoint yourself.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This week, a Moscow judge imposed a new 14-year prison sentence on a former Russian oil tycoon charged with embezzlement and money laundering. The United States and other Western countries denounced the decision as politically motivated. The case is considered one of the most important trials in Russia's post-Soviet era. For more, we're joined by Joe Nocera, business columnist for The New York Times. He's at our New York bureau. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Joe, you wrote that it took the judge, is this right, more than 3 days to read his decision against Mikhail Khodorkovsky?
Yes, it was an 800-page decision, although people who are in the courtroom tell me that basically he was just reading, by and large, from the prosecutor's initial indictment.
Okay. So explain this case briefly to us.
Well, the political aspect of it is, you know, he is Vladimir Putin's number one enemy, and Putin has had him in jail for 6 or 7 years on trumped-up tax charges. They appropriated the company Yukos that he ran, which was, by the way, the best-run company in Russia. They gave it to another state-run oil company. And now, with his parole approaching, they don't want him out of jail. So they made even more absurd charges this time around. And, you know, he was found, of course, guilty as charged.
So 6 more years in jail. From a business perspective, how do you think this will impact Russia's economy?
It's a terrible signal to send to the business community. Obviously, this has human rights and political implications, but the business implication is not insignificant. Russia is a country in desperate need of foreign capital. It's about to try and do a 2-year privatization program where it's going to sell off minority shares of state-run companies. And one of the companies where it's going to sell these minority shares is Rosneft. Rosneft is the company that wound up with all the Yukos assets. So basically, having stolen investors' assets 6 years ago, they now want to resell them, these stolen assets, to a new round of investors. It's part of the reason why Russia has had such a terrible time sort of climbing out of economic difficulty, because foreign investors don't want to do business there.
Now, what about specifically, you know, economic relations between Russia and the U.S.?
Well, they won't change that much. I mean, the Obama administration has, for the first time, made some, you know, moderately strong statements about this case. But the truth of the matter is that the U.S. and Russia have, you know, nuclear treaties and so many things that they have to deal with that it's a little unlikely and a little unfortunate, I would add, that the administration is not going to put this case at the top of their grievances, but they probably won't.
Okay. Well, Joe, before we let you go, it's the start of a new year, and we're putting a twist here on some traditional resolutions, something we're calling New Year's resolutions for other people. So here's your chance. What resolutions would you like to offer for the movers and shakers in the economy?
All right. So resolution number one, the House Republicans and the Financial Services Committee have vowed to reform Fannie and Freddie and try and get the government out of the housing market. Given the fact that the government now guarantees 95% of all mortgages and without which there would be no housing market, I wish them well in this resolution, but I think it's going to go the way of most New Year's resolutions.
Along with the diet, okay.
Right. Resolution number two, Bank of America, their resolution is to modify every loan that is in default. They have basically been knee-deep in every mortgage problem or scandal that has come along this year, you know, taking over people's houses that were not in default, the robo-signing scandal that came along a few months ago, time after time. Unfortunately for them, they own Countrywide, and Countrywide was the worst mortgage maker in the country at the end of the subprime bubble, and so there's another resolution that's probably going to go by the books. Resolution number three for me is Ben Bernanke resolves that the next time he comes up with his stimulus plan, it won't sound like a cruise ship.
Do you have an acronym ready?
Yeah, I haven't figured that out yet. That's my resolution. But, you know, this one was called QE2 for quantitative easing number two. It was hugely controversial, although so far the world has not come to an end because of it. My final resolution is for President Obama. His resolution is going to somehow figure out how to make Elizabeth Warren the official Senate-appointed head of the new Consumer Protection Bureau, which I might add starts up officially in July.
And she's in there temporarily now,
that's
right?
Right, and she's done it without Senate appointment, but she's quote-unquote an advisor to the president, and she is not officially got this job. But you know, I do think she would be the best person for the job. She cares about these issues passionately. She understands them. It's good that she's in there helping to set up this agency. So I'm hoping that this is one resolution that the president, who has proved to be remarkably effective since the November election, is one that he can pull off.
All right. Well, we'll stay in touch with you to see how that goes. Joe Nocera is a business columnist for The New York Times. His new book is All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. He joined us from our New York bureau. Joe, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, and Happy New Year.
The Chanel Boutique at 31 Rue Cambon in the heart of Paris is a glittering shrine to fashion and fragrance. And the most famous fragrance there is Nombre 5, Chanel No. 5.
A woman is not all the time the same. Sometimes we are very cooperating, but sometimes we are very difficult. But being difficult is possibly being cooperating, no? So So let's have a pact, just you and Catherine Deneuve. Don't ever change anything. Chanel No. 5 never has. There are no words for this mystery. We know what it is. Chanel.
Thanks to the lure of ads like that, someone buys a bottle of Chanel No. 5 every 30 seconds. It's been a bestseller for almost 90 years. That lure also hooked author Tilar Matseo, whose new book is called The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume. While powerful women have always regarded Coco Chanel's creations as the embodiment of style, to understand her signature scent, Matseo says you have to look back to her childhood at an austere medieval convent.
She was essentially abandoned by her father after her mother's death and raised in a convent in the southwest of France. And there are two things, I think, about the convent that are very, very important for her. One is that because it's Cistercian and the Cistercians believed in the symbolism of numbers, the number five in particular was all around her. Mm. So I think that's the origin of her interest in the number five. Which
she believed that that was her lucky number,
her sacred number. Well, even her fetishistic number was what one of her her other early biographers who knew her said. Mm. So that was part of it. And then the other part of it is because it was a convent where the focus was on cleanliness and on the scent of soap and linens and fresh scrubbed skin. I think that also was a register of cleanliness that really influenced her interest in scent.
So later on, when she started to think about perfume, in the first decades of the 20th century, there were real class lines about who wore what kind of scent. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was a really a large distinction between them. If you wore jasmine, you were a racy lady. That was really associated with actresses and prostitutes and ladies of the night. Mm-hmm. What a respectable young lady would wear would be rose or violet. So there was a really clear demarcation between the two kinds of perfumes. And one of the things that's interesting then about when she goes on to create Chanel No. 5 is that she was a kept woman by a series of different people. And there was one of the other courtesans that she really admired because she always smelled clean. And that was what she didn't like about the other kept women that she knew, is that they always smelled somehow to her dirty, you know, too much musk and too heavy perfumes. And so what happens in Chanel No. 5 is it takes the heavier scents of musks and jasmine and rose, and then it balances them with adding the scent of clean and that, you know, that thing that makes your nose tingle.
It's also, in its own way, a marketing sensation. She creates buzz for it. Well, you know, today we call it buzz. How does that happen?
Yeah, so the perfume is invented in 1920.
Around Grasse, the famous French
capital. Right, in the south of France. And then what she does is she begins a whisper campaign to launch it. She's very, very clever as an entrepreneur. And so she takes it and sells it only in her boutiques in the beginning. And plans to give it as a Christmas gift to her best clients at the end of the year. And when they love it, they say, we love the perfume, can we get more? She says, oh, I never had the idea that I was going to sell this. This was just a little gift. Do you really think I should sell this perfume?
Meanwhile, she's wiring to Grasse,
make more. I need to sell the perfume. And so it becomes very, very successful immediately in her boutiques. And she's already at this point at the height of her celebrity.
So she signs away her rights to this. She has such a tangled relationship with the perfume after that. Why did she sign away her rights to the perfume?
Yeah, for me, that's actually one of the most interesting things about the entire story is that because she ends up having a love-hate relationship with the perfume afterwards. So she, in 1924, decides that in order to distribute it, she will give away the rights to a group of investors who are perfume distributors and manufacturers. And her concern seems to have been that she didn't want anybody to have any control over the fashion house. And so basically what she said is, it's your perfume. You deal with it.
And, of course, she couldn't possibly have known that it would be as successful as it was. Let's talk about what happens in World War II to her. The perfume. The story becomes like a spy thriller.
It really does. So the investors who buy the
Wertheimers and
the Myers and the Heilbrunns.
French Jews.
Right. So they're French Jews, and so they end up, of course, when the war begins, having to flee. the Wertheimers in particular flee to New York and produce Chanel No. 5 here.
In Hoboken.
In Hoboken, yes. Which Chanel's comment was, it's monstrous. They produced it in Hoboken. And she didn't know about this. So they begin producing Chanel No. 5 during the war here. And actually what happens that turns Chanel No. 5 into and changes it from being just a really famous perfume into being an icon is the intuition that the investors have to sell the perfume through the U.S. Army and the commissary. It's really that decision more than anything that transforms Chanel No. 5 into this just international icon during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to make the perfume in the United States, they still make it with ingredients from France. So there's this great, there's a quote where someone says it's a real James Bond story, and it is, where they have to smuggle jasmine out of the south of France and bring it back to New Jersey in order to be able to produce the perfume.
But it's almost like having bars of gold during the war and just after. And you have mm-hmm. photos in your book of GIs lined up. And, of course, the Nazis wanted it too.
Yeah, that's, for me, one of the most interesting things about the perfume is that you think about the ways in which it encapsulates the history of the last century, right? It's because Coco Chanel is pretty clearly anti-Semitic. I mean, mm-hmm. there's not any getting around that. I mean, not only does she have a German lover and live in the Ritz during the Second World War, but she'd had two lovers before that, both of whom had pretty proto-fascist mm-hmm. politics. And you think, well, you know, you've got a perfume created under the name of an anti-Semitic fashion designer. You have a perfume house that is, in fact, run by a family of French Jews. You have a product that American GIs line up in those photos in the book to get, and then that the Nazi officers also line up to get. I mean, it just cut completely across all of the boundaries of that war.
Like almost nothing else except maybe smoking a cigarette.
Cigarettes, whiskey, and Chanel No. 5.
Yeah.
That was pretty much it.
Tilar Matseo is the author of the new book, The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume. Thanks again for joining me.
My pleasure.
The Pittsburgh Penguins and the Washington Capitals face off tonight in the annual NHL Winter Classic. The game's been pushed back because of rain. Gemma Hooley reports that in preparation for the event, Pittsburgh's Heinz Field has undergone a transformation from football gridiron to outdoor hockey rink.
Ask any player what it's like to skate outdoors and they'll all give you that look. The look Penguins forward Michael Rupp has right now. A secret smile, a faraway gaze, a quick trip back to childhood games on frozen ponds.
Did you ever go swimming in the nude? It's kind of similar to that, I guess. It's it's freeing experience. Like, you're just in there and you got the air around you. You can see it. Just, it's a pretty cool feeling.
But the Winter Classic is no backyard skate. It's a competitive regular season game, which means the outdoor ice has to match indoor quality. NHL Ice Master Dan Craig has been out here for a week now, spraying paper-thin layers of hot water to build dense ice. He makes it sound a whole lot simpler than it is.
I put water in an ice cube tray and I put it in a freezer. And I take a whole bunch of those ice cube trays and I put them down and I make a hockey rink out of them.
Don Renzulli is the special events chief for the NHL. His job is to create iconic visual moments for these outdoor games.
Without snow this year was a little bit difficult, so we have a lot of the fake snow out there. We've painted grass. There'll be strobes going off underneath the fake snow that you'll see. And then at the end of the anthems, we'll have pyro going off on the top of the building.
With the ice built and the stage set, it comes down now to nature's thermostat. Renzulli and Craig have been poring over radar maps and barometric pressure readings.
Yeah, there's rain. They're calling for rain, but we're looking now for rain patterns. So if we can get a pocket of, you know, 3-4 hours in there, you know, that's what we're looking for right now.
The rink crew and ice truck can deal with some rain and with higher than normal temperatures. But the players wear visors, and seeing the 100-mile-an-hour puck in pouring rain will be tough.
It's like your windshield. If you don't turn the windshield wipers on, sometimes you can't see. We want to make sure they're safe. And I think we also want to make sure that this is right for the fans.
Outside the stadium, fans in hockey jerseys crane for a glimpse of the action.
So it sounds like they're doing a sound check, and it's getting a little louder and louder and louder. And they're also doing a little bit of light check around the stands, so it's a great day.
Inside, on the clean ice sheet, Washington Capitals defenseman Carl Alsner had a chance to skate in the team's only practice before the big game.
It's just different. I think just getting that wind in your face, I just like to feel a breeze. I like to, you know, it's pretty much like you're just a little kid again, and that's You know, that's where so many guys grew up learning their hockey.
Both teams will take those childhood lessons learned onto the ice with them in Pittsburgh as fierce competitors, eyes cast skyward. For NPR News, I'm Gemma Hooley.
This is NPR News.